Okay, it's taking a while for the people to reconvene, but I think we must start to keep up with our timetable. Now our main speaker is running away. Very spontaneous. Our next speakers are Christopher Hertel from the Samba team and Jose Rivera, both from Ubix, and they will be talking about Are We There Yet? The Long Winding Road to SMB SIF Specifications.
Sensible. Sensible, right. Okay, just so you know, I supplied Volker with a PDF copy of this presentation, and that copy includes notes. So, hopefully it'll be on the webpage at some point after the conference, and you'll be able to download it with the notes and such. And this is the first time I've ever used this particular laptop for a presentation. So if you have issues, that's why. One of the issues, because there's no transparency on the image itself, you'll see a little subtle frame. I don't know why that happens. But I didn't have that on the other laptop I was using to develop this. It's weird, but it's there. Okay. So I'm Chris Hertel. I'm a member of the Samba team. I don't usually wear a suit, but my wife said I should, so here I am. And a jacket anyway. But there we go. This is my team shirt. Okay. Jose, stand up. Wave. Hi. That's Jose. We are basically founding members of Ubix Consulting, which was a company that we formed out of necessity a couple of years ago, as we'll see. So, introductions. We'll go a little further. Who is here? Who is us? Who is you? And basically, if you don't know me by now, you will never. I've been around for a while. I've been on the Samba team about 13 years, give or take. I don't really know anymore. I think it was 98. I might have been 97. I can't remember. What's happened, though, over the years is that I kind of got tired of the coding aspect, and I started writing down things because when it came down to it, I really, really hated having to bug Jeremy and Tridge and a dozen other people every time I didn't know something. How does this work? How does this work? I don't know. Maybe I think I did that one. I mean, ask someone. Okay, and it would take a week and a half just to find the trail to get to the right person who knew the answer. And it was usually quicker to go back and figure it out all over again myself. So by the time I got an answer, I said, okay, I'm writing this down, right? And that became a habit. Writing it down became a habit, and it became a compulsive, obsessive habit. And the next thing you know, I had a web page, and I had notes on my web page. And then I got a call from Prentice Hall, and they said, "We're doing a series, Bruce Perrin's open source series, and you've got a book." And I said, "Whoa!" And my wife said, "Never again." All right, but for good or ill, that led to me becoming your source for all of the current usable SMB SIFS documentation. And if that doesn't scare you, it should, all right? But right now, anything that's available out there that's useful, current, up to date, has my fingerprints all over it, okay? Jose's too. Jose, stand up. Okay, go ahead, do you.
As it sets up there, you probably don't know me yet, but you will. He hired me on fresh out of college to start working on a project for this little company out in Redmond. And one of the first things that came out of my mouth was, "What's a SIFS? Can you eat it?" I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. He showed me his book, said, "Read this thing." I said, "Okay, now I have some vague understanding. What are you getting me into?"
The main reason we hired Jose, one of the main reasons, was that we needed somebody to use as a guinea pig, because the intended audience for the Microsoft documentation set has to be aimed at recent CS graduates. So I needed a recent CS graduate to read the docs and go, "Huh? Okay." And here we are. But what happened was that we were on target, and he learned it, and he learned it quickly, and the next thing you know, we had him writing sections of the documentation. So he progressed quickly.
And unfortunately, now I've become a leading expert in the world of SIS and SMB.
Help!
That should also frighten you. SIS is probably the most popular, absolutely the most popular network file system on the planet, right? I mean, it eclipses NFS as far as popularity. And yet, there are something like 6-7 books I'm aware of on NFS, and that's what they teach in the colleges. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge about NFS out there. But this room right now contains a good 50% of the SIFS knowledge in the world, right?
Hey.
What? Who's got the other? Well, there are a lot of Samba team members who aren't here.
Due to the volcano.
And there are a few people back in Redmond still, right? Okay, so you're here, all right? There are Samba developers here. That's important. There are Samba supporters. Yay, Ra, thank you. Okay. Samba users, we've had several people say, I use this stuff. Right? That's good. Resellers, companies that are producing products that have Samba in it, inside that. Leveragers of all kinds. And one of the things I like to see and hope to see more of is third-party SMB SIFS developers who are part of our community who understand that really working together is the best way to make this protocol work for everybody. And of course, them. Microsoft is here. You've seen them several times today. I want to point out something. At the end of Jeremy's talk, the person who stood up and said, "What are you doing to evangelize this?" was somebody from Microsoft. Okay? Now think about that. Okay? One of the other things I raised at that point in time was the question of the Asian market, the Asian producers. One of the problems that all of us really in this room have is that we have these inexpensive devices coming from Asia that you plug into your network and at home or in a small office, and it becomes an inexpensive file server, right? And it's something you just plug in and go, you know, cheap thing. We were talking, Hongwei and I were talking about them after lunch. The problem is they're not here. And the problem Microsoft has is that when one of these boxes gets plugged into a home network, Jeremy mentioned this, and the user updates to Vista or Windows 7 or whatever else it is, suddenly that home device doesn't work, Microsoft is the one that gets the call. And what's happened in the last couple of years, which is really cool, is that Microsoft and the Samba team have started working together very closely. And both sides have learned that this really is a benefit to everyone. When we work together, everybody wins. And this is a good thing, right? What happens is that Microsoft wants Samba to be out there more because they know that when we have something that doesn't work right, they can talk to us and get us to fix it. And that's a big plus for everybody concerned, okay? So we're together again at last, all right? It was a collaboration between us and them, Samba team person, me, and them, Microsoft, that produced these published docs that we now have out there, MSSIFS and MSSMB on the Microsoft website. And these are, and I say this humbly, but it's true, the best SMB SIFS specifications since 1992. And in 1992, the X-Open group, now known as the Open Group, X-Open company, produced a document called, I can't remember the full title of that one, but it was an SMB specification, and it was actually a second edition, and then there was also an inter-process communication specification. So if you haven't seen these, you really should, because those were the best documents out there. They cover everything from the core protocol, the original SMB protocol, through to LANMAN 2.0, OS2 LANMAN 2.0. The only thing they don't really cover is the 2.1 extensions, were a couple of small pieces that were thrown in, but there's a document on those as well. Those are very good docs, actually. There were mistakes in them. There are errors, some of which I can point out, but they were very good docs, and they were something that we had to live up to and exceed. And we did, but that's still not good enough, because what we really need is a three-way collaboration, all right? Us plus them produce the docs, but adding you in is what's going to produce sensible specifications. Because the one piece that's missing is people using those docs to implement and validate implementations. So whether you're a user or a Samba team developer, if you're looking at those docs when something goes wrong and you want to know what's going, you're digging into it at some level, that's where you're going to find what should be going on. And if it's wrong, which does happen in those docs, we worked hard, but they still have errors, we need that feedback, all right? So the three-way collaboration provides the feedback and the fixes, okay? So where to start with the new docs? Well, if you don't know about these documents, the documentation set, there's the website at Microsoft to give you the full list. And I think when we were talking loosely the other night, the number 300 came up. I think it's roughly 300 different docs, isn't it now? Jim Pinkerton is nodding his head yes. And these are the three docs you're interested in. MS SIFS covers the Windows NT, being very specific here, the Windows NT implementation of SMB SIFS, okay? We specifically cut the scope at that point. So it's Windows 98 client, but it's the Windows NT server, Windows NT 3.5.1 and 4. That's what that doc covers, because that is the basis. That's the foundation for everything else that comes after it. MSSMB tells you everything that's changed since those original docs, since the MS SIFS doc. So everything from Windows 2000 through to the present. And that means that it's a very active, lively document because things are continuing to change a little bit. Mostly, you know, bug fixes and things like that. But there are changes to MSSMB because even now, people are making small changes, no more new development, but small changes to the SMB protocol in Windows. Okay? And then, of course, MSSMB2, which is not my fault. It's not Jose's fault. We didn't write it. But it's out there. That is the new protocol, and as Tom Talpe said, that is the future. Okay, that's the future of this protocol suite. One of the things to note, though, is that SIFS, as we know it, is not dead yet. All right? It is, in my feeling, Tom said, you know, protocols, old protocols never die, right? What were the words you used, Tom? Is that close?
Protocols are
forever. Protocols are forever. Thank you. Okay? That, by the way, is a picture of the COBOL tombstone that was presented to Grace Hopper, the late, great Grace Hopper, many, many years ago. Okay? COBOL is dead. Here's the tombstone. Okay? How many of you have still seen and dealt with COBOL implementations in your lives? Okay? It's still out there. On the Samba technical mailing list, we still get questions about OS2 interoperability. Right? OS2 interoperability is still a live question.
Right.
Within a week. There you go. So Windows 95. Windows XP is still out there. It doesn't do SMB2, right? And it's still a very popular platform, Windows XP. Windows 98. And as Volker says, Windows, you know, and DOS. There are still applications out there that run on DOS. Okay? So I'm going to hand over to Jose now. He's going to give you an outline of the structure of these specifications. And this is kind of important because there's a defined structure that we have to work within in order to produce these documents, and knowing how to navigate it is very useful. After you.
Thank you much.
Pardon me.
Alrighty. Can you hear me back there? All right, good. All right, simple question. How many of you have actually read these documents?
Yay!
Oh, much better, much better. Give yourselves a hand. I know it's tedious. Congratulations.
Not
what?
Not every page.
Not every page, no. Heavens. I've done about a good 3/4 of it, maybe, at best. But yeah. These things are tedious, but it's tedious because there's a lot in there. We put in a lot of effort to demystify a lot of things, to uncover hidden truths, break old lore, and maybe start some new lore. We fixed a couple of broken assumptions from not just from, you know, hearsay, but also from older documentation. And we also added a lot of Windows behavior notes or product behavior notes, as they're known in the document, to tell you guys what it is that Windows does behind the scenes. And as Chris said earlier, we couldn't have possibly gotten all this right. We need a lot of input from you guys to make sure we can get it as close to accurate as possible, if not completely accurate. All right. How to read one of these things? Hot cup of strong tea is recommended. All right. First thing that you need to understand is that we didn't write this quite as we would have wanted to do so naturally. We've had to fit everything within a particular template. In particular, we had to use something called the block template for presenting the wire datagrams. It's not a developer's dream, and there are some peculiarities, to say the least, in the style that in the text style demanded of it. It's a mix of ISO and IETF styles, and it was put together by non-techies, to say the least. This template was put together largely by lawyers, and it can be a bit of a nightmare to work with. But we had what we had, and we were committed to make the best out of it, and I think we did. You know, just like the rest of us are committed to make the best we can out of SMB and SIPs. Yeah. There are 6 key sections to the template we had to use. And they have their own official names, but you can basically see them like this. There's the introduction, section 1. Section 2 shows you the structure and messages of the protocol. Section 3 is the crazy abstract data model. Section 4 is a bunch of useless captures. And section 5 covers a bunch of security stuff that is generally covered elsewhere. And section 6 is our beloved Windows behavior notes. The introduction, well, is the introduction. Gives you a glossary, gives you references to older documentation, cross-references to other current documentation that you might need to understand this document. It tells you the scope of the document. This one's very important. As Chris said earlier, you know, MS-SIFS only covers Windows NT era protocol. MS-SMB covers everything since then. This causes a lot of confusion to people and causes a lot of headaches to people maintaining the documents who still get questions such as, oh, MS-SIFS says this thing, but Windows 7 does this other thing. Yes, we know it's in the other document. And gives you an overview of what to expect. Not much to say on that one. Section 2, structures and messages. We put the bulk of our beginning work into this section. This is the real meat of the document for most of us. It gives you an overview, a transport overview, and references the necessary documents to explain what all SIFS and SMB runs on. And it defines a lot of constants that were previously defined across various documents. So we tried to consolidate all these things, such as error codes, command codes, information levels, etc. It codifies a lot of structures that are used across multiple commands, not just info levels, but also things to represent timestamps and date stamps, and a per command / per subcommand message layout and field definitions, some of which were simply just not covered in older documentation, possibly because people didn't know they were there. There's also syntactic details and a lot of details on how fields interrelate with one another. And that's really juicy stuff. How does the value of one field impact the meaning of another field in the same command or in a different command or versus the response or the request, for instance? That all is covered in Section 2. Section 3 is the abstract data model. Well, to be fair, it's obscure, convoluted, and unfortunately required. I say unfortunate because partly we didn't want to look at it to begin with. But then we took a closer look at it and realized that it forced us to write down a lot of things that were really missing from documentation of this protocol. It defines state variables. It defines interactions between the state variables and how this abstract state relates to the parameters in the actual over-the-wire messages, and it defines state machine behaviors for both client and server. It's often been said that SIFS is a stateful protocol, but it's never been really documented anywhere what these states actually are. The abstract data model is those states and transitions finally documented. One thing that makes the abstract data model section hard to understand is the way that the template approaches it versus the way that one would intuitively think to approach it. The intuitive sense would be that to just approach it straight from, you know, a state diagram point of view. You have your states, you have your transitions, and they relate in this such a fashion. But the template is also is not just concerned with that, but it's also concerned with maintaining compatibility with the other documents in Microsoft's rich documentation effort. And in doing so, a lot of the maintainers adopt a sort of object-oriented model with which to view these documents, especially Section 3. You can look at the state variables as objects in your object-oriented model of thinking. You can think of Section 3 as providing you the methods for your object-oriented model. Section 2 provides you the data structures on which those methods work on, as well as the variables that you'll be working on. And Section 1 kind of provides the linkage to other libraries, other documents that you will need to make sense of this model. Then we get to Sections 4 and 5, which we call useless captures and redundant security stuff. We're sure it serves a useful purpose to someone, somewhere, somehow, someday, maybe. We're not those people, but it had to go there, and we made the best of it. It includes some example captures for if we're talking really fresh out of CS College and they haven't looked at a Wireshark sniff before, heaven forbid. We provide some captures for them so that they can have an understanding of what it is they're looking for on the wire and try to get their feet wet a little bit. And Section 5, redundant security stuff, is more like a late coming table of contents showing you where in the document or in other documents important security related topics are covered. So if you're coming into this from the point of view, all right, this is something I'm looking to use for my product, or this is something I'm looking to write an implementation of, and I want to know what security concerns I should have, you can jump straight to Section 5 and see where in the document or other documents you need to be looking at. That being said, it's a rather sparse section. It's little more than the pointers themselves, but it gives a good overview. So in that regard, it serves its purpose well. Section 6, Windows Behavior Notes. Oh, this is the good stuff. A lot of really obscure and really bizarre questions are raised and answered and then raised again in this section. The insight into how Windows chooses to deal with certain options and certain scenarios is all covered here, and it's a bit tricky to navigate because you can't just skim straight to Section 6 and hope to understand everything. You really need the reference of the other sections to understand what's going on. They're called notes because they're basically endnotes. This is the endnotes of the document, right? There's something along well over 200 endnotes in this document, and each one of them barely makes any sense if you don't know what the sentence of the paragraph of the section that it came in Section 2 or Section 3, something like that. But once you put it all together, but thankfully the PDFs and the HTML versions include hyperlinks between all these, so you can easily enough skip back and forth between them. And once you put all the pieces together, things start to make a little bit more sense. They may not always answer the question of why things are done this way, but at least it provides you a solid picture of how things are done, thus giving you the developer, the one of the questions, more solid ground to stand on as far as achieving understanding as that goes. Aha! And torque conversion. I'm not entirely sure who coined that term. I see Tom Telfy shying away over there, but Jim, do you know who coined
it? Was it Jim or Tridge?
It was Jim.
Okay. Alrighty, it's not an official term by any means. You won't find that in the document, but internally the process itself was called torque conversion. And what we meant by torque conversion was the process of taking what was on the wire and converting it to Windows internal file system behaviors and then back again. A lot of that is handled by bridges into Windows behavior nodes to other documents such as MSFSA and MSFSCC, file system algorithms and file system control codes. A lot of good stuff is provided in that bridge. We didn't want to put it all in our document because it really is information that has impact on multiple documents. When something, you know, had little impact outside the world of MSIFS, MSSMB, we included that in the Windows behavior notes of the document. But we wanted to make sure that these documents were easy to maintain, and we didn't want any other documents referencing our doc that didn't need to. And certainly we didn't want, anybody referencing our Windows behavior notes from other official specifications. So we have these other documents to take care of all that for us. In particular, NT function call references are covered in FSA and FSCC, and those are really useful to help you understand what you're seeing on the wire and why. We tell you what you see on the wire, but really understanding what it means to get what you're getting on the server side or on the client side is greatly enhanced by having all this information. Puppy!
Okay.
And that's our transition, believe it or not.
So, Jose just gave you an overview of the structure and where it all came from and how it's put together, and that's great. Now, let's go into some details. What we discovered and presented in all those Windows behavior notes and the rest of the doc. Documentation versus implementation versus expectation. Protocol and the implementations are inconsistent. Okay, surprise, people knew this. There are incomplete command implementations in the code, in the Windows code. There are unspecified and unfinished commands, things that were never documented before. And there's some weird things in the error codes. We tried to clean up as much of that as possible, and as best as we could, we tried to say, this is really protocol, versus this is the way Windows behaves. Now, this is interesting because in much of the Windows documentation, what Windows does is the protocol. But this particular set of documents covers an old protocol that IBM created, not Microsoft, and has history, including the XOpen docs, which are published specifications from a bona fide standards organization. So there's actually a standard for what we call SMB. And we have to acknowledge and respect that as we do the documentation here. Error code anomalies. People here in the room, Volker and I know Jeremy, have noticed that every now and then, Windows will return, when you request a 32-bit error code, it returns instead the old-style SMB 1-byte class, 2-byte error code format, right? Except that it doesn't. I'll explain what I mean by that. There are specifically 15 codes that we identified that will return this way. And the thing about it is that the Windows NT server does not clear the 32-bit flag in the header. So the header has a flag that says, I'm sending or receiving or requesting a 32-bit status code. That's in the header of the SMB message. And Windows NT doesn't clear that and say, I'm sending you back the old style. It doesn't say that. It says, I'm sending you a 32-bit code. Okay. Windows 2000, however, does clear that bit when it replies. I've got one of these 15 codes I'm sending you. I'm going to call it an old style class code combination. So in MSIFS, we provide both of these formats, the 16 and 32-bit formats. That's what we did. And the client, what we discovered is the client can actually interpret them either way they like. It doesn't matter. Okay? Here they are. Can you all read that? No. Okay. But it's in the slides, and the slides will be available, and that's why I put the chart together so you could, you know, read through that. Those are the 15 codes that we identified. And what we did was we made sure they all had names. They actually have names as provided inside the code. What happens inside the code is all of the status codes inside Windows NT implementation are 32-bit codes. It's not until the very last moment before the response packet is kicked out the door that the server makes sure that it puts the old-style class code combinations into the message, all right, if that's what's been requested. All right, in that piece of code that does that massaging is where these codes, which are actually stored internally as a special range, are translated back into their class code combination sets. All right, so this is what, so you would take status invalid SMB, on the wire, the old style would be error serve, which is an 02, and error error, which is 0001, okay? On the wire, that comes out as 0001, 0002, nifty. Okay, we just gave it a name and called it a 32-bit code. There's no collision here because those codes would never be generated by a Windows system. They don't fit within the normal pattern. So you can read those codes either way you choose to do so. I just put that picture in because I liked it. Let's pick another one. Saga of SMB Info Volume. I told a couple of people this the other night at dinner. It's kind of fun. SMB Info Volume is an OS2 system call. All right? It's one that was used in the Landman days. It can be called using the Trans2 Query FS Information request. 10 minutes. I'm hurrying. There are several of these, and I'll just cut them short if we wind up going too long. The thing is, a Windows client will never request this info level unless it thinks it's talking to an OS2 server. And an NT server will never expect to get this call except from an OS2 client. Because if a Windows client knows that it's negotiated NT SMBs, then it will never send the request. So the testing team at Microsoft started testing this. All right? And they discovered that when they turned off NTSMBs, cap_NT_SMBs, it's a negotiated capability, when they turned that off, they could generate that particular info level request. The problem was when they got the response back, it was all messed up. They had this name, this Unicode volume name in there that wasn't terminated, and it was chopped short, and it was kind of unaligned, and it wasn't right. Okay? So they went, what the heck is this? And they sent us back a query. What's going on here? And the answer was, what's going on is that if you don't negotiate NTSMBs, the server doesn't expect you to be able to do Unicode. You must be an OS2 client. You can't do Unicode. OS2 doesn't do Unicode. So that piece of code was never checked. Right? That combination is impossible, in quotes. So that's something we documented in the MSIFS document. Okay, it's in the doc. And that's really the point of this whole diatribe, is that this is the kind of thing we tried to capture and make sure it was put in the doc and nailed down. Okay. Hidden secrets. Readx response and writex request. Back in the OS2 days, it was a speed hack. If you look at the, readx response. The readX response has 5 extra words, 10 extra bytes of padding in the parameters section. And that was so that the parameters section would align with the parameters section of the write. And the reason for that is that it was very common to do a read, update, write combination. And by using a single buffer, it was a speed hack. You didn't have to allocate new memory. You didn't have to do as big a copy. So you would read this thing, change the header in the parameters section, make your changes to the buffer and just write it back. And so the only copies you were doing were the header, you know, copying new data for the header and parameter section. So they had them aligned. They had them aligned for this reason. And with Windows NT, they added 4 extra bytes for 64-bit offsets. and that broke the alignment of the two packets. And we found that. We found this commentary. We found this information. It's in the dock now. It used to be like this. It doesn't work like that anymore. It could be that somebody might make use of that or might have made use of that in an older implementation. It's broken. We want you to know that. The severed server FID. Should really have cut off that finger in the picture. But anyway, the severed server FID. It's document. It's a field in the open response that is documented in Leech NAIC, the IETF drafts. And it basically is supposed to be a unique ID from the server that uniquely identifies an open file on the server side. Now, it exists in the code. We looked in the code, and the field is actually there. But it's never used. It's always set to zero. What it may have been was somebody's initial attempt to create durable handles that we now see in SMB2. Should it be documented? We said yes. Okay. We actually got requests back from the technical committee. Thank you. The technical committee, why are you putting them in there? Get rid of it. And the answer we came back with was, no, we think it should be there. And I don't know what the end result was, but Tom went with it. So we'll see what happens. Right? Action-packed mystery bit. I told Tridge about this at dinner the other night. There's an extra bit that wasn't ever documented before. The folks at Microsoft didn't know it was there. When you do a authentication under NT, the old-style authentication, how do you know whether it was your LANMAN response or your NTLM response that was successful? It actually comes back in this bit. Okay? It actually comes back in this bit, and nobody knew it was there. All right, so what our guess is that Samba does is it simply tries both signatures to see which one worked, to know which signing key to use. Because you need to know which hash you used to do the authentication in order to know which signing key to use to do the signing, right? Undead, smbcom close and tree disconnect. There is such a command. It was mentioned in the SNIA doc, never documented. It's actually, half of it is commented out. You can format, it's formatted exactly like a close, smbcom close. If you create that, fill it in, and send it, it will close the file, because it gets that far in the code. Then there's a commented out link that says, go do this other part where you do the tree disconnect. And it's just commented out in the code, and the command is active. You can call it, but it actually doesn't do the whole job. It just does the close part. Okay? SMBcom copy and SMBcom move, these are old OS2 defined commands. They are implemented fully in the code, except that they're wrong, and therefore they don't work. Okay? The Leech NAIC draft actually puts buffer format fields in there. Those are something that only existed in the core protocol commands. Well, NNT rename, but that's another one to talk about. Those particular commands don't have buffer formats, and therefore the strings are read incorrectly on the server side, and weird things, unpredictable things happen in the root directory of your share if you try calling these. Finally, ntcom, ntrename. When I was at the SNIA Storage Developer Conference last year, I asked the audience if anybody had ever seen this on the wire, and everybody said no. And we had Jeremy in the audience, and Tridge was there, I think. And
SMB Torture generates it,
and Cygwin generates it. Jose discovered this. The Linux Sys client can use it now because of the extensions.
No, it uses it for hardlinks.
Well, that's why Cygwin uses it too. What we discovered was the Cygwin developers discovered that there was a Windows NT call that had never been documented because officially NT did not support hardlinks. All right? Officially NT did not support hardlinks, so they never documented the function call that would do them, but somebody in Cygwin figured it out. Somehow they dug it up, and they call it because that way they can compatibly set hardlinks from NT all the way through to modern Windows systems. It's still used. And that will generate this on the wire, all right? The NT rename. Half of NT rename in the code is unimplemented.
We initially discovered how that command worked through random experimentation.
Right.
Random off codes, and then we saw, hey, that one came back okay. And then we looked on the file system to see what happened.
Right. And if you look in the SNIA doc, You will find partially documented NT rename, and there are info level calls and fields in there that are actually not used, and don't use them, you know, please. But it's a half implemented command, and you can generate it. Finally, I have about a minute left. Where do we put all the extra stuff? There's a tremendous amount of information we've gotten into the docs that we produced here, but there's a lot of stuff that is either inappropriate for those docs or just, you know, too wild or special or whatever to actually go there. So one of the things that happened is that Tridge gave Jose and I access to sifs.org, which is a website we are setting up with a wiki. At this point, you need to email Jose with a request, but we'll get you on there. This is not Samba specific, and it's not Unix extensions for SMB2. This is simply a repository for interesting stuff about the protocol. Somewhere where we in the community can share knowledge we have, whatever weird stuff is going on. And that, I'm sorry for rushing, but that's the end. All right.
There are still questions?
Hi, Chris. Great talk.
Thank you.
Just about the captures. The captures you were talking about, printed out captures in the documentation.
Yes.
Are the binary capture forms available on sifs.org?
They're not, but they could be.
Because I find having old captures, particularly of weird combinations,
right.
Windows 95, you know, some of the stranger embedded ones, etc., having those up on a site is very useful. And I've got a bunch of captures that I could contribute. If we had a captures page that people could upload new captures,
right.
Particularly if they were annotated what it was a capture of.
So in our testing and the development work we did to do testing to develop this doc, we produced our own captures and had a wiki internal to Ubix that did exactly that, that annotated the captures. So that's something we could put up. The problem with pages and pages of captures printed out in a document is it just takes up pages. And so we trimmed them down as much as we could so we didn't take up too much room. But having a Wireshark format repository is definitely something we should add to sifs.org, and we have it. We have a starting point for it, so it's very good.
I'll email you about that.
Yep. One more question, and then we must get on.
For the error code anomalies, then, just to clarify, is the implication that that you never have to send those 16-bit error codes? That if you always send the 32 bits. At least the Windows clients will always get the correct error code and do the right thing.
If you send them as 32-bit, yes. Well, again, it depends on what's negotiated. If you negotiate 16-bit error codes, that's what the server should send. But if the client says, "I want 32," and the server says, "You can have it," and in each request you say, "I want 32 on this request," it doesn't matter what comes back because you can interpret it as a 32-bit code. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.